Hi, everybody. I'm Nobody, and welcome back to the second hour of The Nobody Show, where the numbers to call in are 800-213-WEOS or 781-3897. And just a reminder, I will be off next week for Rosh Hashanah and be back in 2 weeks. Well, you can't walk in a newscast these days without seeing some discussion of whether or not it is safe to put a single American astronaut up on the Mir space station, because we would not wish to risk the life of even one person, and I applaud the sentiment. I just wish it was really what our government believed. Because while they're debating very publicly over whether or not to risk one life on the Mir station, in one of the most phantasmagorically extravagant excesses in the annals of civilization, they are preparing to risk the future of the planet with the Cassini-Saturn probe that is scheduled for launch in just, a matter of really weeks or even days. On the phone tonight, I have Carl Grossman, my guest, who is a professor of journalism at State University of New York at Old Westbury, specializing in investigative reporting. He is the author of The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet, and the author of and narrator of a video, Nukes in Space, The Nuclearization and Weaponization of the Heavens. Carl Grossman, welcome to the Nobody Show.
A pleasure.
It's a pleasure to have you here. When is the Cassini probe scheduled to be launched as of this moment?
It was supposed to. I mean, they've been planning this for a while, go up on October 6th. But there's been foul-ups already, screw-ups already. And now they've kind of pushed it towards, they're talking October 13th.
Now, Carl, do you think that I am being hyperbolic when I say this is possibly the greatest single threat to humanity that has ever been tried in a single shot like this?
Well, in a single shot, absolutely. What you have here is the equivalent, if people are not familiar with Cassini, what you have is a lot of plutonium, 72.3 pounds of a particularly hellish isotope of plutonium, plutonium-238, that's 280 times more radioactive than the plutonium we're familiar with, the stuff that they use as fuel in atomic bombs, plutonium-239.
Oh, that's safe stuff in atomic bombs. It's worse than that, huh?
Yeah, really. And, this has a shorter half-life, and that's why they use it on these space devices.
It
breaks down much quicker. It's very hot as it decays, and they have a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, which translates this heat to electricity, very small amounts of electricity. But in any case, the total, the Curie is the measure of radioactivity of the 72.3 pounds is 400,000 curies. If this plutonium-238 ends up dispersed, spread around the planet, which is quite easy considering how they plan to route this thing, it would essentially be the equivalent of all the plutonium released in all the atmospheric bomb tests of the French and the United States and the Soviet Union and China. And we know how many people, we don't really know how many people, but we can kind of
how many people
were killed in all those. And this in one fell swoop would do that kind of damage.
Mm-hmm. And it would, I gather, it would do it in a different way. Why don't we talk about that? They're going to put this plutonium in a spacecraft. It's going to power the probe module, experiments, transmitters, whatever. What is the particular danger? What are the danger points in the mission?
Well, there's three basic danger points. The plutonium-238, they're using it as fuel to generate very modest amounts of electricity, an average of 745 watts, basically to power the instruments on this space probe. And the probe is ultimately to go to Saturn.
Mm-hmm.
The first danger point is, of course, the launch. They plan to use a Titan IV rocket. They're afraid to use shuttles on these missions now. In fact, I broke the story 10 years ago about how the Shuttle Challenger's next mission in May of 86 was to be one of these plutonium shots. So they're fearful of using the shuttle. They're using a Titan IV. It's a military rocket. They've acquired it from the Air Force, NASA has, which actually has even a poorer launch record. It's a 5% failure rate. In 1993, for example, an identical Titan IV launched from the Vandenberg Air Force Base seconds after launch, just was fireworks in California, and blew a spy satellite, a nearly billion-dollar spy satellite, to smithereens. So what you could have on October 13th, or whenever they're going to, if they can't be stopped, and I think every effort must be made to stop NASA from doing this, if there's a launch pad explosion, you're talking about the Cassini space probe, they call it, being blasted to smithereens. And the question here is how the plutonium might be released, because it's in the form of pellets. And there's some thinking that the pellets might stay together as pellets. On the other hand, NASA, in its environmental impact statement, admits that if the plutonium modules, the little packages of plutonium, fall to a hard surface, and like what's the launch pad site? It's all hard surface. But they admit if it falls to a hard surface, there'll be a breaching and the plutonium would be released. But the issue here, and this is the key issue with plutonium, whether it would be released as dust or respirable particles. The plutonium has been described over and over again through the years as the most toxic substance known, because a millionth of a gram will induce lung cancer. But if this stuff stays as pellets, people are not going to get the dust in their lungs to get lung cancer. But on the other hand, if there's a big explosion, there is a possibility that the pellets are not going to stay as pellets, but we're going to end up as dust in a cloud. In fact, in the cover of my book, The Wrong Stuff, is a photograph taken of a rocket which was launched earlier this year on January 17th of 1997, the same spot that Cassini is to be launched. It blew up. A cloud was formed out of the fuel, and the cloud floated out to sea, and then had the winds blow off the east coast of the United States from the ocean off, and the ocean winds took the cloud, brought it back to Florida. It began floating down the coast of Florida. People as far off as Vero Beach, 73 miles from Cape Canaveral, was told to stay indoors, turn off your air conditioner and so forth, air conditioner and so forth. Now, the same thing could occur on the Cassini launch if there's an explosion on launch, but this time the cloud would not just be full of toxic chemicals, but laced, again, possibly with plutonium. Second danger point of the launch, and NASA doesn't consider the flight over the ocean up to orbit as too much of a problem, but they figure that if there's an explosion on the way up, the thing will fall into the ocean and the plutonium will be the problem of the fish. And in fact, plutonium in water, even though it's a problem, I mean, it shouldn't be dismissed, it doesn't have the extraordinary super toxic capability of plutonium airborne as dust. I mean, Dr. Helen Caldicott, founder and longtime president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, she'll say that a pound of plutonium has hypothetically the potential to give a lethal dose of lung cancer to everybody on the planet. But this is if it's spread around again as dust. In any case, over the ocean it's supposed to go, and then the next danger point is over Africa. They're flying this thing over Africa. And they say in the environmental impact statement, if there's an accident and the thing falls on Africa, again, if the modules hit a hard surface, the plutonium would get out. Then it's supposed to go up to orbit if it gets that far. And the deal here is that the Cassini isn't to go directly to Saturn. It doesn't have the propulsion power to get to Saturn. There's simply two rockets involved, the Titan IV, which takes it to orbit, and something called the Centaur, which is to fly it beyond orbit. And the Centaur doesn't have the oomph to get it all the way to Saturn. So what NASA plans to do is to send it instead to Venus first, have it circle Venus twice, and then have it come hurtling back at the Earth. I mean, in my judgment, like, this is Three Stooges go to space. I mean, to have this thing hurtling back at us from Venus at an incredible speed, 42,000 miles an hour, it's faster than a bullet, and to come very, very low. I mean, it's supposed to do what they call an Earth flyby.
This is what's also called the slingshot maneuver.
It's a slingshot maneuver or gravity assist maneuver, and part of it is the swingby or flyby. And they made up all these lovely words. And it's supposed to come in at less than 500 miles high, And if it doesn't come in 500 miles high, I mean, if it dips into the Earth's atmosphere, which itself is 75 miles high, and it would have flown many millions of miles in space at this point, and there's very little margin for error, but if it dips down and hits the Earth's atmosphere, then there's no question. Then it isn't an issue of hitting hard surfaces or the pellets staying, you know. Then we're talking dust, and we're talking respirable particles, and we're talking vapor, and we're talking about this stuff getting all over the planet, and we're talking about exactly how you opened the show, about an absolutely words couldn't describe it, horrific, colossal, terrible accident, which could leave many people dead. I mean, just let me just go to the environmental impact statement. This is the final environmental impact statement for the Cassini mission. Here, fuel, particle, and vapor. For all reentry cases studied, this is page 4-51.
This is an official NASA document.
Yes, the official. My background is in investigative reporting, and I don't believe what PR people tell me, frankly. And the NASA PR people, their spin now is, well, the plutonium is not going to get out. It's not going to get out. Yeah. Well, why, in fact, you talk about how the plutonium will get out and as dust, the pages in the environmental impact statement, which they're compelled to file under the National Environmental Policy Act. So here they can't lie. In their press releases, they have no trouble lying. Fuel, particle, and vapor for all reentry cases studied, not some, all, 32-34% of the plutonium fuel is expected to be released at high altitude, and the fraction of the fuel particles released estimated to be reduced to vapor or respirable particles. Again, this is just what you don't want. This is what Alan Caldicott has been talking about, and because it would spread all over the place, would range from 20% for steep reentries, 66% for very shallow reentries. And then I go into another page. This is 4-76. And here's some more lovely NASA wording. In the unlikely event of an inadvertent reentry, they call this thing an inadvertent reentry, and I'm just quoting NASA here, approximately 5 billion of the estimated 7 to 8 billion world population at the time of the swing by or flyby could receive 99% or more of the radiation exposure. And they go on to say that that'll result in 2,300 fatal cancers. I provided the NASA data to a variety of independent scientists, and they range, they give the range of death anywhere from a couple of 100,000 to Dr. John Goffman, who is a giant in the field of nuclear technology, co-discoverer of uranium-233, an MD, PhD, long-time professor.
And long-time anti-nuclear activist as well.
Now. Yeah, well, he became that after he became aware about what he was the associate director of Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, and
right.
In the 50s, the
What's
Atomic
his
Energy
estimate?
Commission told him to set standards for radioactivity, which was, ridiculous. And as a matter of conscience, he stepped out, and he's been speaking out about what he sees as to be the true consequences of exposure to radiation and so forth for years. He says that based on his analysis of the NASA stuff, you're talking about, at least a million deaths. At least a million deaths. In fact, here's a letter Goffman wrote me.
A million deaths within what time period are we talking?
We're talking about, people don't fall in the gutter immediately. They get a piece of plutonium in their lung and die. NASA's talking about 50 years. The scientists I'm talking about are talking about decades. But it's unclear, there's a latency or an incubation period here.
Could we have a scenario in which a billion, 2 billion, 3 billion people ultimately die as a result of this?
No.
That's over the top.
No,
that's more
I think that's, you're talking here probably, about the highest level that I've gotten of death toll is Dr. Ernest Sternglass. He's professor of radiological physics emeritus at University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. He figures based on, he's strictly NASA data here, so you got some problem. You got to believe what NASA's saying. But based on the NASA data, he figures up to 40 million deaths. So I think that's really what you're talking about. It's kind of the equivalent, like I mentioned before, the 400,000 Curies. released during all the atmospheric tests of all the nations.
I have to tell you, I'm actually reassured. I thought the upper end estimates were much higher than that. I'm glad to know we're just talking about a mere 40 million deaths.
I don't know.
I still think it's insanity, but, you know, I was worried that they might, when they talk about the 3 billion or 4 billion or 5 billion people absorbing 90% of the load there, I thought that meant all 5 billion might be having their health compromised.
No, they're talking about 5 billion people receiving doses, talking about in the millirem, small amounts. But the issue here is that everybody's not going to get, like, you know, it's not going to be evenly distributed. Everybody's not going to get, if some people will get more, some people will get less.
Truth be told, we don't really know. There's a lot we don't. We haven't got a series of experiments to verify what's going to happen with a thing like this.
Of course not. It depends where it falls out. I mean, if a lot of it falls out by chance in the oceans, and three-quarters of the planet is covered by water, that makes it better. I mean, this stuff isn't going to all come down at once either. The environmental impact statement says it'll come down over a number of years. So, I mean, lots of people are going to get plutonium in them.
What happens if it rains on this vapor cloud?
With rain, the...
Does it come down and can pollute the land so you can't grow crops?
Yeah, that'll occur.
Yeah.
I mean, if the plutonium falls down on somebody's farm and they plow the farm, you know, in the spring, you kick up the plutonium and so forth. I mean, you're going to have a load of plutonium. It's the equivalent, essentially, because it's 280 times more radioactive than plutonium-239. It's the equivalent of nearly 20,000 pounds of plutonium-239 falling out, and that's a lot. I mean, we're talking, again, the most toxic substance known, plutonium, and it'll be around for centuries. It'll be around, and you can end up with a speck of it in your lung. You end up cremated, and Dr. Caldicott relates this possibility, and I quote her in the book, The Wrong Stuff. She talks about somebody being cremated. But the plutonium isn't extinguished or neutralized by the fires or crematorium. It just goes up the stack, and somebody's walking nearby and takes a breath, and boom, that hot particle of plutonium gets into her or his lung. So what we would be releasing here is an awesome amount. Well, just let me read Goffman's letter here. What is so, he talks about just the one-third of the plutonium getting out, and of that, 20 to 66%. Being reduced to respirable particles. And let me say that that's debatable. A whistleblower from NASA who has been...
Alan Cohn, were you talking
Alan about? Cohn, who emerged a few months ago. Actually, he called me up sitting right here. He had read about me speaking in Florida, and I got on the phone. He says that, look, my name's Alan Cohn. I've worked for NASA for 30 years.
And he was a safety officer for NASA.
He was the emergency preparedness operations officer.
Yeah.
And he said, I'd given a presentation in Florida, in Orlando, and he said, I'd read what you said about the dangers of the Cassini mission. I said, oh, you know, all I needed, frankly, it was another NASA character calling me up when I have a debate. And he says, you're absolutely right, absolutely correct. He goes on about how he had, you know, been there in the last, been in charge of radiation protection, the last two big nuclear shots, Galileo and Ulysses, and how he had seen what they call the footprint, where the plutonium would go. And he says if there would be a launch explosion and the plutonium would be released, and there was 50 pounds on, nearly 50 on, 49.2 pounds of Galileo and 24.2 pounds in Ulysses, he says that plutonium would be released. He said the footprint would have taken it as far as Orlando. I mean, you wouldn't want to go to Disney World for the next couple of hundred years. And he went on about, you know, they say these things are indestructible. He says they're indestructible, just like the Titanic was indestructible. And he went on about how... it's time to put NASA, stop NASA's, it's time to put a stop to NASA's freedom to threaten the lives of people here on Earth. I mean, he's got a strong statement. And I mean, I couldn't believe it. And finally, we talked for a long time, and he agreed that he really decided that he was going to come out by name. First, he just wanted to, you know, kind of give me information. And in any case, he's emerged as a major whistleblower.
He's very active.
He says,
hang on about the Goffman letter and things, because we have a caller on the board, and I want to get to the caller.
Well, just let
go
me
ahead.
That he said it's 100% release, not a 32 to 34%. This thing hits the atmosphere at this speed. You're talking about all that plutonium getting out.
So that estimate of 40 million deaths, 200,000 to 40 million, that's based on a one-third release.
Yeah, it's based on their data, right?
So, in other words, if he's right and it would be 100% release, that would actually be then maybe three times those estimates.
Could be.
All right, those numbers to call in here, 800-213-WEOS or 781-3897. Joe from Ithaca, welcome to the Nobody Show.
Two things I want to talk about. One, we've been talking a lot about the effect it's going to have on humans directly, but there's a lot of other life living on this planet with us.
Good point. Excellent point. And we shouldn't be anthropomorphic on this thing, because, in fact, just for starters, it was determined, the toxicity of plutonium was determined in the 50s and 60s with tests on beagle dogs. And they put a speck of plutonium in the lung of a beagle dog. The Atomic Energy Commission did these lovely tests. And that's how they determined this stuff was the most toxic substance known. And might I also note that beagle dogs only, and I mentioned this in the book, I quote a number of scientists pointing this out, beagles, they tested these plutonium on originally, have lives of about 20 years. So here you have human beings, you know, with lifetimes of 70 and 80 years, which are much longer latency period. So actually the toxicity could even be worse than thought. I mean, what this will poison, you know, every living form on Earth. It's just a horrific threat to life on Earth. Good point, Colin.
And the other thing is, I think the main reason they want to be using plutonium on this is because they're dying to weaponize space. You know,
yep.
They're setting up for that other experiment where they're going to shoot down some satellite and
right.
say, you know, our one neutral spot in our universe
right.
essentially is going to become a new battlefield for fighting some foe that we don't even know who they are.
Yeah, but you're right there. And in fact, in the book, The Wrong Stuff, I do a chapter devoted to the military interest in nuclear-powered weaponry in space. And I start the chapter I call The Ultimate High Ground, quoting actually from Air Force doctrine, U.S. Air Force, U.S. Space Command doctrine now, regard, and this is post-Star Wars stuff, regards space as the high ground from which to position weaponry, particularly high-powered like laser weaponry, and exercise what the doctrine calls, the strategy calls, space control, which is controlling space with weapons, and a space force application, which is controlling the Earth below with these new high-powered weapons they want to deploy in the next several years.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem that they have, they admit, in the strategy or the doctrine, is that, let me just read. This is from a report I quote called New World Vistas, Air and Space Power for the 20th Century. And they talk about how there are power limitations to space-based weapons. They talk about how what they need is a lot of power up in space. Quote, a natural technology to enable high power is nuclear power in space. And it goes on, is the U.S. Air Force without tax money. Setting the emotional issues of nuclear power aside, this technology offers a viable alternative for large amounts of power in space. How this fits into Cassini, I mean, Cassini is a civilian mission. It's a shot to survey Saturn. I don't know if it's worth $3.4 billion to do this. But
or risking 40 million lives.
Well, yeah, at least. You know, I mean, and this is the most expensive space shot ever. But the connection, the military connection, is why is NASA ignoring the solar option? I mean, we're talking, again, just 745 watts of electricity being generated by the plutonium.
And they could use solar power. You're saying they want to prepare us for the idea of using plutonium in space.
That they want to do. This is an icebreaker. But also, NASA got closer and closer. With the end of the Man on the Moon missions, the Apollo missions, seeing its budget begin to drop, NASA jumped into bed with the Pentagon. And a lot of space programs now, including the shuttle program, are half military, half civilian. So at this point, it wants to stay in lockstep with the military. The military wants to see nuclear-powered weaponry in space, so that NASA rejects the safe solar option and stays with the RTGs and has other kinds of programs. I mean, there's many nuclear missions that NASA is planning in the future, and it wants to keep in coordination with the military. And the caller was right there. What he's referring to, the caller, is something called the miracle test. Again, they love this language, without an E at the end, called miracle. It has to do with a laser that NASA, that the Air Force wants to test this month, have it shoot off from the White Sands Proving Ground with a 6-foot-wide laser beam and blast a satellite. It's a $60 million satellite. They want to blast a smithereens to show how the laser works so nice. On the ground, you have plenty of room to, like this particular energized by chemical propulsion. But up in space, you don't have all that room. So what the Air Force wants is nukes up in space to energize.
All right, let me move on here. Joe, I want to thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Good talking to you. Thank you.
Good luck to your cause here.
It's an important one for all of us. Thank you, Joe. Those numbers to call in again are 800-213-WEOS, 800-213-WEOS, or 781-3897, 781-3897. Frank, now from Romulus, welcome to the Nobody Show.
Yeah, I moved out to Romulus so I could have a dog.
All right, well, congratulations on your move and on your dog. What's your question for Carl Grossman?
Well, I've read several articles, Scientific America, New York Times had a couple articles in their science section about this Kikizi mission, and they don't agree with you. So they're the experts, and...
Well, what do they say?
Basically, that it's safe, you know, that there's minimal risk, no more risk than the shuttle.
Okay, Carl, what do you say to that?
Well, I got into this story I was mentioning before, the shuttle, back in the 80s. In 1985, I read in a Department of Energy newsletter about two shuttle shots in 86, one being the Challenger's next mission involving these plutonium probes. And just like the caller, you know, I mean, I at that point was trusting the experts, so to speak. And yeah, my background is investigative reporting, but I thought maybe NASA was different from the Internal Revenue Service or the Immigration and that. I mean, I had respect for NASA from seeing Neil Armstrong on the moon and all. Well, I filed a Freedom of Information Act request to get information about accidents that could occur on these two shuttle shots. And right off, I had trouble. It took me months to get any information. And right there, I knew, I mean, if there was the smoke of a cover-up, there might be some fire of a major issue. Finally, when I did get information in late 85, and this is very pertinent to the claim that the probability of a catastrophe on the Cassini mission is very small, what NASA finally told me was that, yeah, if the plutonium got out, it would be a horror story, but the likelihood of a catastrophic shuttle accident was 1 in 100,000. And I didn't move on the story then. This is late 85, figuring that, you know, you don't want to make a big deal as a journalist about something that's so unlikely. Like the caller, I believed the experts, and man, frankly, I feel like I was a fool. I was manipulated by the NASA PR, and they're fantastic figures. I mean, in science, you only know true probability and odds by experiments, by empiricism. And I finally began writing on this story. I was driving to work to this state university I teach at, to teach my investigative reporting course. I also teach environmental journalism, but that semester I was teaching investigative reporting, and I heard about on the car radio the Challenger had blown up. I run into an appliance store, see the 100 TV showing that image, and clearly it wasn't 1 in 100,000. I then began writing. The Nation magazine did a piece by me a few days later, headlined "The Lethal Shuttle." And NASA, meanwhile, changed its odds of a catastrophic shuttle accident from 1 in 100,000 to 1 in 76. So NASA's big defense on this thing is not that there's you know, not, there wouldn't be a, I mean, let me just read a chart. This is a chart I actually reprint in the book from the Environmental Impact Statement, where they talk about what they'll do if the plutonium rains down, like if it comes down on agricultural land. Ban future agricultural land uses, or here, natural vegetation, relocate animals, I mean, how the hell are they going to do that, remove and dispose of topsoil, or urban, demolish some or all structures, relocate affected population permanently. You imagine if it comes down to New York or San Francisco or Moscow or Paris, they're going to relocate affected population permanently, and also, very importantly, you're not talking about a few square blocks, they give a footprint in terms of, I guess this is the flyby accident of the plutonium raining down, and they're talking about 50,000 square kilometers. But in answer to what the caller
That's like
saying,
relocating the state of Rhode Island, then.
Really, yeah. We all move to, I don't know, where Jersey is. What the caller is saying is that, yeah, it's safe. The big argument that NASA makes that it's safe is that the odds, NASA says, are, you know, it's 1 in the 1,500 chance of a launch accident, which, frankly, are not good odds. I mean, imagine what a...
Given the risk.
A lottery has, you know, odds of 1 in millions.
Well, if you're talking about a 1 in 1,500 chance of stubbing your toe, you consider that a low risk. If you're talking about a 1 in 1,500 chance of killing 200, 500,000, a million people, well, the magnitude of the risk has to affect your assessment of the odds.
You also got to figure the history of this stuff. I mean, there's been 26 U.S. nuclear shots, three mishaps, including in 1964, there was the Snap 9A, was a plutonium system on a satellite that didn't achieve orbit.
That's still in the ocean somewhere, isn't it?
What's that?
That's still in the ocean. Then.
No, this is not in the ocean. It came down and disintegrated. Plutonium spread all over the planet. I quote...
Well, Frank, what do you say to this? Are you still feeling sure that the experts are right, the ones that you think are the experts?
Yeah.
I mean, this is Professor Grossman. He's looked at the actual data. What's more of an expert than that?
Just because it's not going to break up and spread that far.
How do you know?
And if it does spread, in fact, that would be even better because then it would be still dispersed and wouldn't affect anyone.
Only a small bit, sir, will affect somebody. If you breathe in a little particle,
you
can get, so if it's spread all around, that's terrible.
Burns up in the atmosphere.
But, Frank, what Professor Grossman is saying, if I understand at one point that was, I thought, an important one, shouldn't get lost, if you launched a million shuttles with plutonium, and you counted the number that blew up, and you observed where the plutonium went, at the end of that process, you'd have a pretty good experiential base for saying what's going to happen when this thing goes up and what are the odds. We haven't had that many shuttles. We've never had a launch like this. How can their estimates be anything more than guesswork?
They're the experts. So.
I don't know. Let's trust, we're the government. Trust us. I don't trust them. I don't trust them at all. I
was studying for the ministry in college once, and before I became a biology major. But one of the favorite sermons the liberals like to preach is risk. And I'm not sure why, but for the gay population.
I'm getting lost, Frank. But let's stay on this topic.
Okay. Well, life has a lot of risks. Now,
Frank, you're prepared to take this risk is the bottom line.
Yeah, because the experts.
Fair enough. All right, that's your opinion. I want to thank you very much for the call, Frank. Yeah. Good talking to you. Professor Grossman, you want to respond?
Yeah, the argument of risk is an interesting one. I mean, I live on Long Island, a part of New York State where you got to go on the Long Island Expressway. You want a risky road. It's a risky road, but you don't have the mass transit that they have perhaps in Europe, and I have to get to the university from far out on the end of Long Island and got to take the LIE, but this trip doesn't need the risk. I talked about the Snap 9A. That came down in 64. It spread plutonium all over the planet. In fact, I quote from a European report done by a grouping of European nuclear agencies and radiation protection agencies saying that by 1970, debris of the Snap 9A was found on all continents and at all latitudes. Goffman has long connected the 2.1 pounds that got out of the Snap 9A to an increased level of lung cancer on Earth. But what NASA did, and this is important on the issue of risk, then it got its solar act together. During the 50s, early 60s, the nuclear establishment was, you got to use plutonium on satellites. I mean, the plutonium on the Snap 9A, incidentally, was there to generate 25 watts of electricity. You don't even find 25-watt bulbs too often. I mean, nothing in terms of electricity. What NASA did, and you pick up any book on solar photovoltaic energy, it became a pioneer in using solar photovoltaic. And now all the satellites fly with solar power, and there's no issue. It's safe. Nothing's going to come down,
That's why we're hearing about solar panels breaking on the mirror, because that's what they've got is solar power.
That's what they have. They stayed with the plutonium on deep space probes because in the 60s and the 70s, they figured that you couldn't go far from the sun and harvest solar power. But by the 80s, and now by the 90s, you can. I mean, I was over in Europe earlier this year on this issue. Turns out that the European Space Agency has developed high-efficiency solar cells. In fact, made a major announcement that I report about extensively in the book in 1994, technology milestone, that they've developed these solar cells that can go on deep space probes, and I mean deep space. In the announcement they talk about, and plans are now underway on this in Europe, to send up the Rosetta space probe, which is going to have just solar, not plutonium. It's going to go beyond the orbit of Jupiter, I mean way out there, to rendezvous with a comet. And the solar system is going to be generating, even way out there in the solar system, watts compared to 745 watts the plutonium would generate on Cassini. And then at this conference I was at in Darmstadt, there was a representative of the company, Deutsche Aerospace, that has done these solar cells, developed the solar cells for the European Space Agency, under a budget, incidentally, of $3 million. I mean, that's like a fraction of the office budget of NASA. And, you know, he said, sure, we could do Cassini with solar. You'd have to redesign the space probe. But, you know, it can be done safely. We can fly Cassini with solar. So in answer to Frank's issue about, oh, we got to take the risk, we don't have to take the risk. We can do it safely with solar. And in terms of risk, beyond even to life itself on the planet, and again, even that environmental impact statements chart talk of, as the other caller noted, relocate animals. So it isn't just the people, it's the life on the planet. Beyond that risk, I mean, I think anybody who's a booster of the space program, and I got a kind of sense that Frank might have been, has to realize that if we have a Cassini flyby accident, if we have a disaster, and it may come on Cassini or it may not, probably won't, you know, I mean, hopefully it won't if these characters go ahead with it, but there's so many other nuclear shots planned in coming years by NASA. I mean, I just saw a piece in Space News that NASA wants to send up two entire nuclear power plants up to Mars if they don't fall on our heads on the way up.
Well, the Challenger is the perfect example. We'd all gotten so complacent they were putting a teacher on board.
Yep.
And then, boom, it went up. So the more of them eventually will get complacent. That complacency is no protection.
Yeah, it's inevitable that we're going to have a catastrophe which is going to cripple the space program. So anybody who's a believer in the space program, in my view, like the last chapter in the book is titled Saving the Space Program from Itself. And that's a quote from Professor Michio Kaku, Dr. Kaku, who's a professor of nuclear physics and an ardent space buff. You know, in my view, let's explore space. You know, I mean, it's probably humanity's destiny to explore space. I don't know if we should spend all this kind of money. I mean, there's all kind of needs down here, medical needs and educational needs.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything on Saturn worth spending that kind of money.
I mean,
for,
there's
period.
Not even rocks with names on them on Saturn. It's a gaseous planet. They say Titan is very, you know. But, I mean, it's $3.4 billion when, you know, people still, you know, people... Students can't get student loans. People on Medicare and Medicaid
right.
being shorted out, and we're going to spend $3 billion. But in any case, I kind of believe we should probably, in a more reasonable way, in a more in terms of our priorities, explore space. But let's not destroy a portion of life on Earth in the process. And in fact, we don't have to, except for the corporate and the bureaucratic. And the military interest pushing new nukes in space. I mean, the caller before got us into the military area and how NASA wants to stay in lockstep with the military. The other reason why plutonium is being, the other two reasons, and this is important for listeners to understand, is one, the corporate pressure, and this is probably the most obvious. This stuff was made, these plutonium systems, for years by General Electric, which doesn't exactly bring good things to life, let me tell you. And then Lockheed Martin, a couple of years ago, acquired GE's aerospace division, and it now makes these things. Well, two summers ago, the Cassini mission was canceled, was zeroed out by, and this has nothing to do with politics, the nuclear and space issue, by a very conservative congressman from California named Jerry Lewis and a subcommittee that he chaired of the House Appropriations Committee. They just knocked it out because of the cost. At that point, it was $2.7 billion 2 years ago. And in fact, I heard about the zeroing out of Cassini. I was on the road speaking on this issue, Colorado, when I got a call actually from my partner on the Nukes in Space video, Steve Jambeck from New York. He said, David, you hear? I just saw a little thing that canceled out Cassini. Well, I got back to New York a couple of days later. I called the House Appropriations Committee, and I said, I hear the Cassini mission has been canceled. And the press aide, and I quote all this conversation in the book, said, yeah, absolutely, 2 days ago, it was done. The subcommittee, Jim Lewis's subcommittee, canceled it out. But wow, did Lockheed land on us? And I've seen lists of like campaign contributors to congressmen and so. Lockheed Martin is. I mean, it's the world's biggest weapons producer, and it also makes the Titan IV rocket. So you know, it's been pushing the Cassini mission. Then you have the national nuclear laboratories like Oak Ridge and Los Alamos and Argonne, and where I am here on Long Island is a place called Brookhaven National Laboratory, which has been deeply involved in developing actually nuclear propel rockets. At Brookhaven Lab, they developed a particle. plutonium, but like little Three Mile Islands, little Chernobyl's pushing rockets. These national labs have been pushing nuclear in space, and in connection with that, the Department of Energy, which is in a promotional mode in terms of nuclear power, it also pushes nukes in space. You have the corporate, you have the governmental, and you have the military connection. And here, all our lives, can be very much affected. And like what the caller Frank was saying, I'll leave it to the experts. I don't think that's what democracy is about, leaving anything to the experts. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that you put a lot of poison in a rocket, and it can blow up, and that poison will be all over the place. You send the rocket heading back towards you for a flyby, and you're playing Russian roulette, space-borne nuclear Russian roulette. And I don't think we can leave these kind of things, or a lot of things, anymore to experts. I think we gotta figure these things out ourselves, and particularly when it's a matter of life and death, and our lives and our deaths, and our children's lives and deaths, we all together gotta make the decision.
I couldn't agree with you more. Those numbers to call in again, folks, if you want to call and talk I guess it's Dr. Grossman.
No, not even on TV or radio. I've been a working journalist.
All right, Professor Grossman. Our 800-213-WEOS, 800-213-WEOS, or 781-3897, 781-3897. I want to return to the public relations aspect of this, because we're basically being sold our own demise here.
Yeah.
When we had this Mars probe that just a couple weeks ago went into orbit around Mars, and they wanted us to think what a magnificent achievement NASA has just made. They wanted us to know how difficult it was, and I remember them saying that putting this thing in orbit around Mars was like throwing a baseball from Los Angeles through a particular window in New York. They really wanted us to know how hard it was.
Yeah.
Is the maneuver that the Cassini is going to make around Venus and back through our atmosphere and on to Saturn so much easier than putting something in an orbit around Mars?
No, this is a trick and a half. And there's such, you're talking about disinformation and then they're PR baloney. I remember the first time they ever did a flyby of Earth. This is the third time. The first two times involved that Galileo space probe with the 49 pounds of plutonium on it. And they decided they had to do a flyby of Earth because the astronauts, these are the last two shots that were done on shuttles, the Galileo and Ulysses. The astronauts wouldn't fly the shuttle with the Centaur rocket, what they're using on a Cassini, in the cargo bay because it's liquid fuel, very volatile. So NASA changed its plans, figured out to use a solid fuel rocket called the inertial upper stage, but it didn't have the power to get to Jupiter. So what they did was the first time they did a flyby of the Earth. They had Galileo come hurtling back at the Earth in 1990 at 600 miles high, 1992 185 miles high. But all during that period, they said that, we do planetary flybys all the time, NASA said. Yeah, Mars and Venus and stuff, but never with the Earth as the target, and never with plutonium on the damn thing. Then they did a report that I got through the Freedom of Information Act from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory called Earth Avoidance Study Report. Would you believe our tax money is going to go Earth Avoidance Study Report? Mm-hmm. And they say that, this could be really dicey. Maybe we should raise the flyby altitude to like 20,000, 30,000 miles. But then they say, well, we wouldn't be able to get that slingshot effect if we do that. And so we just got to take the chance, have it come in very low and very fast. That came in about 32,000 miles an hour both times. And so we got through two space-borne bouts of Russian roulette, and now we're going to do the third. Oh, now this is real important. After the launch of Galileo in 89, I had filed under the Freedom of Information Act when they rescheduled those two shuttle shots of 86, one Galileo, one this thing called Ulysses, which was to be sent up. This was the Challenger's mission. This was to be sent up to orbit the sun. I mean, you need a plutonium system on a probe you're going to send up to orbit
the sun. Well, where would you get solar energy from?
Yeah, like a hole in the head.
Yeah.
But on the Galileo, they claimed for 3 years there, 87, 88, right into 89, we got to have plutonium on Galileo. It's going out to Jupiter. It's far too much out there to use solar. We just can't. In fact, there was a lawsuit that was filed by the Christic Institute and the Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice and Jeremy Rifkin's Foundation on Economic Trends challenging doing the wisest, the safest, the cheapest thing any government agency has to. Well, it took me here 2 years, when they rescheduled these two shots, 87, 2 years to get basic information on consequences. And I wrote them, I said, hey, folks, it ain't 1 in 100,000 chance now. Let's talk about the true odds. Again, they went to 176 real quick. And the true consequences, a lot of the stuff that I'd gotten in, back in 85 was censored, heavily censored, on grounds of national security. NASA had whited out references to the number of people who would be left irradiated and the land left irradiated. So I said, come on, like on grounds of national insecurity, let's talk, let's get the numbers. So finally, it took 2 years of real heavy kind of pushing. And just before the Galileo launch, a few months, I got the data on consequences and so forth. But the one thing they didn't touch was the alternatives. One thing they didn't touch. And again, you had this suit going in Washington in federal court. And finally, I mean, this is after NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory people swore on the Bible, literally, that there was no alternative than to use nuclear, the plutonium, on the Galileo. 2 weeks after the launch, after the judge said, okay, then you got to have the thing go ahead, you're taking the wisest route under the NEPA, and Oliver Gash was the judge's name, gave NASA the go-ahead. 2 weeks later, I get this batch of reports from NASA, from my Freedom of Information Act request, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, including, let me just read from one, I have it in front of me. Here's the summary. Study results indicate a Galileo Jupiter orbiting mission could be performed with a concentrated solar array power source. No insurmountable system-level barriers preclude using solar on this mission. I mean, these bums had lied. They could have used solar on the Galileo. I mean, what we're facing here is, you know, in my judgment, something that government, corporate power, it's like big government, big business, big science, kind of out of control. And the attitude of some people, like I'm afraid to say, like Frank before, is trust the experts. No, we can't trust the experts.
And worst of all, if we survive this one, which we well might, our reward is that it's just the beginning for more worse to come.
Exactly.
So what is being done to stop it? What is the organizing?
Everybody's gotten bad news now. Yeah. The good news is that people are becoming more aware of this. And there's actually an international movement to fight this stuff. Again, I was in Europe. I was speaking on it in many countries. There's a group called the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. What listeners should do is to give a call. I'll give you a couple of phone numbers here.
Go ahead.
The Global Network is based at the Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice's offices in Gainesville, Florida, 352-468-3295. I'll go slow. 352-468-3295. I would urge people, the video I did, and I have to do videos like a hole in my head. I mean, I'm frankly, I could just teach my classes, but I put the video together as a consciousness-raising, I've been in TV through the years, but I mean, to knock ourselves out on that video, Steve and I took a lot, but I did the video you're not going to hear about this kind of stuff. I mean, who owns NBC? GE. Who built these plutonium systems for years? GE. Who was the prime contractor on these nuclear-propelled rocket schemes I was talking about? In fact, the Clinton administration a few months ago revived the whole program for nuclear-propelled rockets for military and civilian uses. Westinghouse, who owns CBS. So that's why I did the video, so people could have it, could show it in churches, show it in community groups, show it at schools, get the info out. To get a copy of the video, give a call to 1-800 Eco, like Ecology TV 46. That's 1-800 Eco, like Ecology TV 46. Anybody wants to get the book, and that's also was a matter of working to put this stuff down on paper and to just show their own documentation, so people would be empowered with the information, not just on the Cassini thing, but all this stuff ahead. People know what's going on. People can obtain it at a bookstore called Common Courage Press up in Maine. 1-800 497-3207. That's 1-800-497-3207. And, you know, I mean, there's other groups. The Florida Coalition, the Global Network is real important.
They're going to have a demonstration at the time of the launch, as I understand it.
Yeah, right? they're going to do a civil disobedience on October 4th Cape Canaveral Air Station.
They're regardless of whether or not October 4th is the launch date?
Yeah, yeah. It's set for October 4th. Right. I mean, you don't want to be around there.
You know, there's one point we didn't get to, which I really want to wedge in here, which is they had an accident there with the insulation, and they have to do stuff to fix the rocket now, and their launch window is closing. Isn't that the very worst circumstance for a launch when they're in a rush?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The sense I get out of NASA is like it's like the eve of Challenger. It's like the eve that is so desperate to do this thing because they know the momentum is building. I mean, not only do you have grassroots action with there's going to be a demonstration in front of the White House this weekend, a demo in front of the White House. If anybody, you know, wants to get involved, that'll be happening. There's a group out of New York called Love Earth that's organizing the demonstration at the White House. But beyond that, you have a growing congressional movement against this thing. You have Jerry Nadler of New York dead set against it, trying to get a postponement until this thing could be flown safely with solar power. Bernie Sanders of up in Vermont, Lynn Woolsey of California, Ron Dellums. I mean, it's growing every day, and I'm very much in the middle of it. You can see the momentum growing as people get the information. Because my stories about this, not too incidentally, have been cited by this project out in California at Sonoma State University called Project Censored, and they cite the most underreported stories of.
And yours was number one, I believe.
Number one this year, you know, and it's the nuclear and space issue has been. I mean, the stories I've written, mostly the Nation magazine, Covert Action Quarterly, Extra, mostly the alternative media. Thank heavens for the alternative media, and on like what you have here, radio stations of this sort. Particularly WBAI in New York, they've reported this information. But as the information finally, I mean, after 10 years I've been on this story, finally it's marvelous for me to see the information getting out. Momentum is building, and I think that if they can't, and they know it, if they can't get off this launch, this initial window, which runs till the end of November 2nd. If they can't launch this thing in October, I don't think this thing will take off. I think that the momentum.
We're about out of time, but doesn't this make it just that much more dangerous, like a wounded rat, that they're going to do
reckless
it?
Reckless and dangerous. Oh, just one of the number, if I can give that Love Earth group, if you'd
sure.
like to join
okay.
the demo at the White House, just give them a call at 718-426-5361. That's 718-426-5361, and you'll find about the demonstrations take place Sunday.
All right,
September 28th.
We're out of time. This is certainly madness, and I want to thank you on behalf of my listeners, not only for being my guest, but for your years of work bringing this to light. And I've enjoyed talking to you. I hope it's reached a lot of people, and my good wishes to you with your continued work. And thank you very much for being
it's
on the show.
It's been a pleasure.
All right, it's got to be possible to bring sanity to something. Because as I always say, if you don't believe in miracles, you're not a realist. I'm Nobody, and I'll be back in 2 weeks.
You've been listening to The Nobody Show, produced in conjunction with 89.7 FM WEOS Geneva. If you'd like to reach Nobody by email, his address is radio@lightlink.com. Internet services for The Nobody Show are provided by Lightlink, and the opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of Lightlink, this station, or Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Tune in again in 2 weeks for the next edition of The Nobody Show.